The Dirty Dozen, Ireland's motorsport legends in conversation with John Kenny. This week, Michael Rowe.
Michael Rowe is perhaps the one Irish driver that got away. Rowe worked his way up the world motorsport ladder, winning the British Formula 4 Championship and Festival in Brands Hatch. He also won the Can-Am Series in the States, and here he explains just what winning the title meant when he spoke to RTÉ Radio back in the 1980s.
The Can-Am started off originally as a challenge between the United States and Canada. It was a series of four races. It's now a series of 12 races, and you compete both in Canada and in the United States. Yeah, we had a very good year. We have a very good team owner. We have a very good team, you know, very good crew people. I felt very at home with the car, so everything went very well.
Michael Rowe set a new lap record at the Dallas Grand Prix and was all set to race in Formula 1 with Tyrrell until his career took a nasty twist. I met him at his home in Naas, County Kildare.
I was born in 1955 on the Sandlands Road in Naas. It was a very small town then, with a population of about 3,000. Obviously, you knew everybody in it. I went to national school in Naas until I was 12, and then I went to board in Newbridge College and finished there in 73, I think.
You played rugby while you were in school in Newbridge?
Yeah, it was nearly compulsory at that stage.
Rugby actually permeates a lot of your life. I mean, I know you're married to your wife, Gay, whose father was Dr. Carol Mullen, who played rugby for Ireland. So it's one of the other sports, I suppose, that you're very much involved in outside of motorsports.
Yeah, I've always been keen on as a spectator. And then more recently, back in Naas, following Naas, and then my son Shane was captain of Newbridge College of the senior cup team, and he's now playing with Naas, so I followed that on from there.
Did your dad have any interest in rugby at all?
He played a little bit. In fact, I read in an obituary of his that he was one of the only people who played in Croke Park, Dalyman Park and Lansdowne Road in the same year.
So he had an interest in cars, we know that, and I know he did some rallycrossing with various different cars that he actually cobbled together back in the when you were younger.
That's right. In fact, his first interest was motorcycles. He was a frequent visitor to the Isle of Man, and he recounted great stories there of the great Ernie Lyons. But he always had an interest in cars. And in about 1973-74 time, he decided to take up autocrossing. And I remember the little special he bought was £100. In 1975, then, we decided to buy a Formula Ford car. It was the ex-Bernard Devaney Crosley 25F. Thankfully, it's the only car we ever had to buy since.
Yeah, that was an interesting year now when you bought your first Formula Ford car, you say, in 1975. You were a stuntman that year in the movie The Blue Max, I heard, driving an old Hummer.
That's right. It was some sort of an old special. I remember it was brought to Naas Cinema, and we had to do various laps around Naas and Mondello in it. Yeah, that was. I'd forgotten about that. That was 1975 also. Mm. And in fact, we earned enough money out of that to buy the Formula Ford car and race it for the year.
There were some strange stories going around that time. Not just you, but I know the likes of David Kennedy and Derek Daly went off working in the Australian mines to try and earn money as well. So it seemed that anything goes just to go racing.
Yeah, they went working in the mines. I worked on the films, driving that Hummer. That raised enough for the 1975 season. I was lucky then at the end of 75, John Murphy arrived in Ireland and he had an agency for the Royal cars. And John supplied the car, Alden supplied the engines, and we maintained it ourselves with John Murphy's great help. And I think we won everything in Ireland that year.
There was a good crop of races around that time, wasn't there? And we mentioned Daly, Kennedy, and you mentioned as well Bernard Devaney, a very good friend of yours, who went off to, in the end, race in Formula 2.
Yeah, Bernard was a great driver. Actually, the late 70s in England, the Irish took over everything in Formula 4 in the late 70s. Derek won the festival in 77, I won it in 78. I think Tommy Warren won it in 79. We were unbeatable worldwide in Formula Ford. A lot of it was due to the connection with, which we made with Ralph Fermin. Ralph was married to Angela from Kilcullen, and he was very favourable to the Irish. He was a tremendous help to me, Tommy Warren. Derek drove Van Diemen for him. Right through, he's been a great help to Irish drivers.
And you mentioned John Murphy's were in 76 and the Royale. That was in the Irish Championship where I think you won 9 out of 11 races and you were pretty dominant that season. And you won the Irish Driver of the Year award as well, didn't you? And James Hunt presented that to you.
That's right, yeah, that was 76 in the Royale. But one of the big races that year was the works teams came over to Mondello. Derek with Hawk, Jim Walsh was driving the Royale for the factory team. And one of my great memories is Rory Byrne, the current Ferrari designer, in the garage at home, the Sands Road, helped me set up the car and get it ready for the Sunday race, which we duly won.
After winning the Irish Championship then in 76, you decided to keep your racing career going. And in 77, you decided to move to the UK. You were third in the British Championship that year?
Yeah, 77 I went with Ralph. He supplied the car, and Scholar supplied the engines. Yeah, I think we were third in the championship there, and second in one of them.
There was stories around that yourself and Bernard went exactly sticking to the rules at times. There was time, was it Alton Park, somebody said that you'd decided that enough was enough, and you go hop out the window and for a few jars, and Ralph found out about it and wasn't too happy about it when you got back.
That's true. There are various stories about that. One of the funniest stories I can remember is actually in 1978, we'd won the Donington Festival. It was a big prize for them. It was £500. Ralph was there and he said, "That's great, job well done, forget about it." But we all went for a few jars with in the Donington clubhouse, and towards the end of the night we forgot, there was a race meeting in Truxton the following day, we forgot that we were told not to go there. So we duly loaded up in the transit and headed for Truxton in convoy. I won the race the following day in Truxton, set a new lap record, and I rang Ralph from a payphone to tell him I was in Truxton, and he roared at me, "I told you not to go to Truxton." But Ralph, I said, Royale with Kenny Atchison just introduced a new car. Well, we beat them, won the race and set a lap record, and he changed his mind then. He was okay.
You raced a lot against Kenny Atchison, didn't you? In fact, one of the series, I think it was the 1000 Torrenson, that you could have won, but you, one of the rounds you passed him under a yellow and you subsequently lost it by 3 points after getting the 12 points deducted for the race win.
That's right, yeah. Kenny was a fierce competitor. One of the biggest things I learned that year was we had to develop the car. At certain circuits, we were on long corners. We were slowing a lot to Kenny. And one incident at night time, we just happened to be passing a chassis and it happened to turn the crankshaft, and the crankshaft started to tighten up. So a major that night, I called Dave Baldwin, the designer. And I said, "I think we found a problem here." So he came down to the workshop, it was possibly 11 o'clock at night time, checked it out and decided to make a new engine mounting system. And I think for the last six races, we literally tore away with every race.
Tell us about the festival that year. I mean, you haven't won the British Championship, but the festival, as we know, in motor racing terms, especially in the heydays of Formula Ford in the 70s and 80s, it was a huge thing to win. There was 190 competitors there. They were from countries all over the world, 20-odd countries around the world. And you mentioned that Derek Daly had already won it, and Tommy Byrne wins it the following year. So the Irish had really taken over. But it really was the first focal point that international teams would look and say, right, where's our next set of drivers coming from? And invariably, they looked at the Formula Ford Festival.
Yeah, the biggest thing in the festival was getting through the heats. You had to be careful not to get knocked out. So in the early stages, you had to be very careful. And that was the key to win the festival, being careful and measured early on in the races. I think it was in the semi-final, I had a massive battle with Bernard Devaney. He was driving a PRS at the time. Something happened at the top of the carburetor. The top came off and had a bit of a misfire and he overtook me. And the second last lap, I went around the outside of my paddock. And obviously Ralph wasn't very happy about that because I was taking a chance.
Well, the higher up the grid you obviously finished in the race, the higher up your grid you started for the next one. So
that's right.
Did you start in pole for the final?
I started in pole for the final, yeah. I knew I was going to win it. We had everything right. The car was right. The engine was right. I worked a lot down in Scholars, the engine builders. So I was very confident I was going to win it.
So what was the plan then straight after that, 1978, winning the Formula Ford Festival and doing so well in the British Championships? You decided to go Formula 3.
Went with Chevron. I had an offer from a guy called David Clark, car dealer in London. Started off very well. There was no problem with money, but we only realised about three races into it that they didn't have money. I was used to a very intensive testing programme and professional setup with Ralph Furman and Van Diemen. That was lacking in the Formula 3 and the Chevron setup. Bernard Devaney had a Chevron also that year. Eddie Jordan started in a Chevron that year. Eddie changed to March about four races into the season. Bernard stuck with a Chevron also, but to no avail, so we just slid further down the field.
And obviously, with the car being a bit of a dog, it was just a disappointing year, and obviously the money was starting to dry up.
Oh, there were some bright moments. First race, I finished third in a European round at Donington. I won the Gunnar Nielsen Challenge race at Donington.
So what was your racing career like then, saying after Formula 3 and before you went to the States? I know you didn't go to the States till 81. Huh?
Nothing really in 80. I had various chances to go back with Ralph in, I think, Formula 4 2000. There was nothing really in Formula 3 because we didn't have any budget. But then Ralph started to market quite heavily in the States, and he suggested I go over there and give him a hand with, you know, setting up cars and doing the races. And he set up a deal over there where had a chassis and engines, and that was 81. We pretty well won everything over there that year.
But did you think after the Formula 3 day or Formula 3 season that where you had limited success and you said budget problems as well, that your career was starting to stall?
It had stalled. There are various things I could have done in the UK vis-a-vis Formula Ford again or Formula Ford, but I having won the festival and having had success, I didn't want to stay at that.
83 was your first jump into the Can-Am series. Tell us a bit about the Can-Am series. What exactly was it?
The name comes from Canadian-American series. They're single-seater, closed-wheel, open-top sports cars. They're in a 302 cubic inch engine, which is 5,000cc. They had to be Chevrolets, obviously. Loads of downforce and very, very fast.
Sixth in that series that year, a couple of third places as well. So it wasn't a bad start to the series. I mean, how many was competing in that series back in those days, 83?
The top ones were Jack Villeneuve, Jim Crawford. They would have been the leading two. But we came into the series late with an old Lola. But we got a couple of results, and then Count Van der Straaten's cars, the video, they put the cars up for sale, and Don Walker decided to buy them.
Mm. Tell us about this guy, Dan Walker, as well. He was the money man behind you, wasn't he? A real estate man, plenty of money.
He was the man. We used to sell things like brake fluid and duct tape, just to get a little bit of extra income. And this particular crew with this Can-Am car kept, and they were buying litres and litres and litres of AP brake fluid. So I said, what are you doing with it? What's the problem? I said, we can't bleed the brakes. So he asked me, would I come down and have a look at it? So I came down and had a look at the car, and they had one of the rear calipers on upside down, so the brakes wouldn't bleed. So I got talking to the owner, and he asked would I come along to his workshop in Dallas, and that's where it started.
And he obviously took a shine to you because he invested in you.
He did. He bought the VDS Can-Am team. I asked him to hire some people towards the end of 83, which he did. And basically he gave me whatever I wanted in terms of personnel. We set out on a development program at the end of 83, between 83 and the start of the 84 season, to improve the car. And it worked really, really well. I think we broke every lap record in the States with it.
Well, the 84 season, I mean, it was a case then. You were running your own team. 7 wins, 10 pole positions, 7 fastest laps. Jim Crawford was your nearest rival that year. And you fairly blitzed the field.
The last race I ran out of fuel, which there's a story behind that.
So why did you run out of fuel?
At the start of the year, the promoter of the series, they had what they call a triple crown. And they picked out 3 races during the year. One was the first one at Mossport, which I won. I won the second leg of the triple crown at the Dallas Grand Prix. The bonus was $100,000. And it was a lot of money at the time because the dollar had reached parity. So it was £100,000. The promoter was to have taken out a 9-1 bet with Lloyd's. He was to pay a premium, and he hadn't paid his premium after I'd won the race. Mm-hmm. And I got nobbled in the last race. One of their accountants decided, well, he was always part of the team, and he decided he'd work out the fuel windows for the last race. Two laps before I was to come in, he just stuttered to a halt.
And when did you find this all out?
I called a meeting for 8 o'clock the following morning. When we got to the workshop, our crew chief, tools, bags, baggage, everything was gone. So we did a bit of investigating. We rang Lloyd's of London. No, the premium had never been paid. So,
what was your feelings about that?
I was very disappointed. Not so much in the bonus, but I could have lost the championship. If a couple of other permutations had gone against me, I could have lost the championship.
But you didn't. And again, rather like the Formula Ford Festival win back in 78, the 84 win in the Can-Am series again was bringing to people's attention. Is it true that Tyrrell rang you to go to Japan to race Formula 1?
We were sharing the pits with Tyrrell in the, between practice sessions on the Saturday and the Friday and Saturday. And I got friendly with him. And after the race, I broke the lap record in the Dallas Grand Prix. We were faster. Niki Lauda was the fastest Formula 1 car. We were about a half second quicker than him in the Can-Am car. So Ken Tyrrell asked me, would I go to Australia? So I applied, I rang home, and through the good officer Wilfie Fitzsimmons, he organised the Grand Prix licence, which that was done pretty well overnight. I was all set to go with Tyrrell, and Don Walker, the guy who was driving for, wouldn't release me. He said he had big plans for IndyCars the following season, and he waved a carrot in front of me, partly out of loyalty, partly out of stupidity, I decided to stay with him. And unfortunately, he ended up in jail the next year.
Was that the biggest turning point in your motor racing career then? Obviously, you had the offer from Tyrrell, a couple of races to go, you could have finished off the season, and lo and behold, Dan pulls you back.
Robert Moreno went, I think, instead. And there would have been a big change in the Grand Prix cars at that time, you know, because there were probably a bit less horsepower. There were lighter cars to drive than Can-Am cars, and I'm sure I would have fitted quite well in. So it was a missed opportunity, but...
Still hurt?
A little bit.
Yeah, do you sit at night thinking what it could have been? I mean, because your motor racing career at that stage had gone through two different series where you said, right, I'm going to win, and you had won in both.
That's one little regret that I wasn't headstrong enough to just go and do it, or ruthless enough to go and do it. But there are lots of other reasons why I didn't. I probably wasn't the pushiest guy. I might like the social end of things a bit more than other people, and I probably wasn't as professional as a lot of the boring drivers that are around now. But
did your social life come in the way of your driving?
I'd say it did, yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. I went and did a few IndyCar races with Ron Hemelgarn. Again, that was another uncompetitive team. With, I think my best result, I finished fifth in Portland. And so then they changed drivers around, and they were never in the top 15, 16. And that team petered out as well. So from there, it was into sports cars.
And some decent cars about, because you were driving for Nissan and for Aston Martin.
In fact, my first sports car race was in 84 in Japan. The World Sports Car Championship for John Fitzpatrick, driving the Skull Bandit Porsches.
86, you did this Fuji 1000K with Kenny Atchison.
Yeah, we drove for Toyota that year. Had a few rows with Kenny up and down. Got on very well with the owners. In fact, I went over to Lola for a seat fitting to drive for his former 3000 team in Japan for 87. They were sponsored by John Player Special, JPS. I had the seat fitting, that everything organised, and then about the middle of February, Tetsu Ikuzawa, who was a Formula 1 driver one time, the owner of the team, called us, JPS pulled out. So we're in limbo again.
Were you getting paid at this age?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Yeah, Japan paid well.
You did Le Mans for a couple of years as well, you did 89-90.
Did Le Mans with Aston Martin. Aston Martin started out, it was going to be a massive setup. They had budgets of $30 million, and what we're hearing all this. Ray Malik was the engineering director there, and he was fantastic. We started with that car at the start of the season, qualifying sort of 20th, 22nd, and at the end of the year, we were qualifying 4th and 5th behind Jaguar and Porsche. We had a very, very good team organised for that year, good drivers. Gary Anderson was going to join us as designer. And again, at the last minute, it just fell apart.
It was up to 1990. I mean, what else did you do then after that in your racing career?
I drove for some races for Nissan in the States. I drove for Nissan in Le Mans with Jeff Brabham and Derek Daly. Of course, we had a problem at Daytona with Derek. Derek was driving for Jaguar. The longest race, or the 24-hour race, and of course, we collided in the second corner. That was a funny incident.
Did you enjoy your years in sports cars?
It was very enjoyable with Aston Martin because we did a lot of testing. And there were very, really good people involved. Ray was tremendous. You know, I'd look on Ray Malik and Ralph Farman the same light. They were totally dedicated to what they were doing. They understood the nuts and bolts of it. There was no bullshit with them. You found something wrong, you fixed it. A lot of other high-profile teams were more image than, you know, their image quality was much better than their engineering quality. The one thing I've noticed throughout the years in motorsport, the amount of money that's been wasted in people just not knowing really how to get it right.
When did your career come to an end?
Le Mans 1990. Yamaha took over the Aston Martin factory, and they were building this supercar to compete with the McLaren F1 supercar. It was going to cost $600,000 or $700,000, so we spent a year working on that, which that brought us all around the world, both on the road and on the track. That was very enjoyable because you could see progress each week, and their plan was to run this new car in a new sports car series. But it seems to be the story of my racing that Yamaha pulled the plug on that as well.
Well, when you look back, and if anybody, you know, a younger guy is saying, my career in front of me is going to include a Formula 4 Festival win, a Can-Am series in the States, driving sports cars, and outside, I suppose, of not taking that decision to go to Tyrrell, do you have any major regrets about that season or the career that you had spanning, what, 25 years?
I regret some of the teams that I've driven for I shouldn't have driven for. I should have been more patient with Formula 3. I should have been more patient after winning the Can-Am Championship. You must remember, in those days, like, I never had anybody like guys nowadays are managers and the management groups behind them. We were just, you know, dealing from coin boxes, really.
And as I mentioned before, you did have that gang of Daly and Devaney and Kennedy and Tommy Byrne and yourself all around as well. You know, some very good class drivers. Some went on to do Formula One like Derek Daly. David Kennedy tried really hard, didn't qualify for any of them. Tommy Byrne did the same thing.
In my opinion, Tommy was the talent. He was an exceptionally quick driver. I remember at a test in Silverstone, I went to him. I think it was after he won the festival. There was a test in a Formula One, McLaren, but Tommy was unbelievably quick, and he made a comment about the handling of the car to Ron Dennis, which Ron Dennis disliked. I think that was the end of Tommy with any of those guys. Gary Anderson taught the world to Tommy. You know, I'd been with him through the Anson days and was there that day of the test, the Formula One car. And he could tell you stories that would make the hair stand up on your back.
Did you make good friends of those days? I know you're still very much in contact with Bernard Devaney.
I was very friendly with Tommy. Tommy Byrne stayed with us quite a bit in the States. We drove together for Budweiser in the Daytona 24 Hours in March. I helped him any way I could to get drives. But I don't see him much now. He's down in Florida somewhere. At a professional level in motorsport, you don't tend to make friends. That's one of the reasons why I enjoy team sports such as rugby or GA. The camaraderie is a lot different. I would certainly have more friends that were mechanics or crew people than drivers.
They're your team you're talking about, basically the people around you. But the drivers on the track, it's like a swimmer or a cyclist or an individual athlete. Their target is very much tunnel vision. Whereas you say the team, rugby, soccer, Gaelic, whatever, is built around players on the pitch.
Yeah, very much so. And I'm a big advocate of team sports for kids, more so than individual sports like motor racing. So it doesn't lend itself to, you know, friendships that you might see in other sports.
Motorsport Ireland decided to initiate a Hall of Fame, and they've inducted the likes of Billy Combe and Rosemary Smith and Derek Daly into it, and you as well in 2002. Was that a proud moment for you?
Very proud and very honoured and delighted to be asked. There's one guy I think should be approached in it, and that's Rory Byrne, whose parents are Irish, and I think he's at it. He's offered so much to motorsport. I think he'd be a very worthy recipient.
Overall, you've had a terrific career, do you think? I mean, as I said, we mentioned some of the regrets which you didn't take. Obviously, the move to Tyrrell in Formula 1 being the biggest one of those. But if you look back in those years that you raced, from starting with autocrossing with your dad right through to 1990 and finishing up in Le Mans, was it a good career?
I've had some amazing times. Loved it when I was at it. I had downs, but the great times were great. I possibly should have stayed on the States. But I felt at the time with our first son was, Gabe was pregnant with our first son, Shane, at the time. And I was in Japan, commuting to Japan from Dallas. I didn't like it. I just felt it was time to come home. Having come home and seen the kids grow up and enjoy themselves around Nace, I'm glad I made the decision from that point of view. From a racing point of view, it would be much better staying in the States. But I have no regrets.
We're sitting in this house now that you bought in the mid-80s, obviously with the few quid that you had then with the racing. Obviously, it was a good investment all those years. So Nace is where you started, and Nace is where you're living now. It's a place I still had to call home.
Oh, it's always been home. It's always been home. Even when I was in the States, this was always home. As I say, Savage loves his native shore. So hopefully I'll never have to leave here.
And you mentioned as well the fact that how difficult it has been to make friends in the motor racing circles. And you're more focused on team sports, and you're involved in a Nice Rugby Club.
When I say in motorsports, I mean really at a professional level. You know, I still have loads of friends that are from Mandela, from the early days, that, you know, that they're purely doing it as a hobby. They're all great friends. But from professional racing, there are very, very few. I love team sports. I love watching Needham playing GA, Nace playing rugby. Any former GA rugby I love. I would certainly go to a lot more matches now than watch motorsport.
Did you ever sneak down to Mandela Park to have a look?
Oh, very much so. Go there whenever we're not involved in a rugby game, I'd always go down or big meetings. But I don't have an involvement in it, and it's so expensive now for what you get. It was relatively much, much cheaper when I started, and yet there was something to achieve, because you had Works Formula Ford teams in the UK who were looking for drivers with no money. You don't have that now. You don't have to. You have to have a bundle of money no matter where you go now. But in those days, you could try everything, and if you want something, you'd be offered something in the UK. As I say, that car we bought at Barnes, that was the last money we ever spent in motorsport.
Do you think it's lost its romance?
I think it has in a way, because there are so many more classes in both in the UK and in Ireland now. In Ireland then you had saloons, Ford, Formula Atlantic. And of those three classes in Ireland, you could take your outfit to the UK and compete with the best over there. But that's, our finger was on the pulse then. We were, our eyes were on the dyno all day long. We didn't have managers. We had no motorhomes. We had no mobile phones. It was just purely focused on, I want the best engine, I want the best chassis. So the only way to get that is to be sitting down in the engine builders or sitting in the factory building the car. Brazilians would come over and, they'd turn up for their testing or they'd turn up for their race and they'd be gone straight afterwards. We'd straight back to the factory working the cars, straight down the engine builders working on the engines. We were very focused. The only reason we're focused is because we had no money. We couldn't do anything else. As simple as that.
Thank you very much, Michael Rowe.
Thank you very much, John.
Next week on Ireland's Motorsport Legends, Robert Dunlop.
You know, I remember going over Ballagh Bridge and going round the left turn when I was opening up the throttle as well. And I changed into about third gear. And I just remember the bike end going round and me going over the top of the tank of the bike. I didn't know. I thought the suspension had collapsed. But I mean, I knew I was falling off, but I don't remember hitting the wall.